Isaiah 13:1-13:22. The 14th talk in a series on the book of Isaiah was presented by David Crabtree on June 20, 1999, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1999. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Isaiah chapter 13. The text takes kind of a turn here. The passages that we have been looking at have been announcing the coming of this ruler, this righteous ruler that will judge the wicked and that will establish a righteous reign in Israel. And now in the text there's this break, and it seems to be a whole different section that we're entering into. And this new section that we're entering into is a whole series of prophecies about the punishment that is going to befall all of the surrounding enemies, historical enemies of Israel and Judah. And this then is the first of those prophecies. Now, the prophecy, the first one that we're going to read, I'll just read the first verse, verse 1 of 13. It says, "The oracle concerning Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amos saw." This is very strange because Isaiah is writing this. Isaiah lived in the 700s. And most of what we have seen up to now is Isaiah is prophesying the coming of a nation that is going to exercise the wrath of God on Israel and Judah. And that is Assyria that he's talking about. And so the coming of Assyria is something that Isaiah is looking into the future towards. We have had no mention of Babylon yet. Babylon is just a little province within Assyria. It isn't much of an entity, and it's thoroughly subjected to the rule of Assyria at this time. And yet what we're going to get into next is a prophecy concerning Babylon, and in particular it's going to be about the destruction of Babylon. So what he doesn't tell us and what happens historically is Assyria does indeed come in into Israel and Judah and conquers Israel, the northern kingdom, and almost conquers Judah, the southern kingdom, but then Assyria falls into decline and is subsequently conquered by the Babylonians, who then come in and attack Judah and conquer Judah and take the people of Judah into exile. And then it's only after that that Babylon falls to the Medes and the Persians. And that's in the mid-500s. So he's talking about events 200 years in the future, and events that he has not prophesied the intervening events. These are events that are way in the future and not connected to anything that he's talked about up to now. So it's a very strange and abrupt shift that's taking place here. Let's read the first five verses. The oracle concerning Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amos saw. "Lift up a standard on the bare hill. Raise your voice to them. Wave the hand that they may enter the doors of the nobles. I have commanded my consecrated ones. I have even called my mighty warriors, my proudly exulting ones, to execute my anger. A sound of tumult on the mountains, like that of many people, a sound of the uproar of kingdoms, of nations gathered together. The Lord of hosts is mustering the army for battle. They are coming from a far country, From the farthest horizons, the Lord and his instruments of indignation to destroy the whole land. It doesn't tell us who is involved here. We just get this picture, this image. And as I read this, this reminds me of some films that I have seen by, I think it's Sergei Eisenstein, who is a Russian filmmaker in the early 1900s. Everything in black and white, but reading this, I think of a film. And in this film, here's essentially the picture that I conjure up as I read this. That we can see there's this, it's happening in this hill that is absolutely barren and dusty and desolate and wind-blown. And we see the standard being raised. And Isaiah has used this symbol previously. The standard being raised is a call for armies to assemble. So when the standard is raised, soldiers come from all around and assemble at the base of the standard. So the standard is being raised on this desolate hill. We don't know who's raising it. All we see is the standard coming up. And we see this arm beckoning, waving for the troops to come. And a voice is raised calling them. So there seems to be an urgency about it. The raised voice and the beckoning hand, they need to come quickly. And they start coming from every direction. Probably starting out, we see them in the distance as small figures like ants coming towards this standard. And they're coming from all over the place. And as they come, you can tell by their demeanor certain things. One is, they are on a mission. They are the consecrated ones. They have a calling. They have a mission. They have a real defined purpose. They are mighty warriors. These soldiers that are all coming are not, they are not going to be easily defeated. They are overflowing with confidence. They are the proudly exulting ones. And they are agents of God's anger. So this is an ominous sight. These are determined and capable soldiers that are coming to this standard and responding to the call. And God is behind it all. They are agents of his anger. And this army is absolutely huge. I've never seen a swarm of locusts, but I've heard of such a thing, and it's kind of reminiscent of that. Just a large number, and the sound itself is awe-inspiring. I heard recently a report on NPR about a fellow who has a tree. He was in Ohio, I think. He has a tree that's infested with gypsy moths. And I guess the sound is just, it's a constant sound of these larvae eating the leaves. And he had somebody from the city come out and spray the tree to get rid of them. And that worked for about 5 or 6 days, but they're back and just as many. It just sounds like a mess. But in any case, this is the kind of image that I get is these soldiers that are coming are just so numerous, and they're coming from all over the place. It's almost like a locust invasion, and you can hear the sound, the tumult. And they're coming from from very far away. They're coming from, it's literally the end of heaven. So they're coming very far away. So they're coming. These are people that you wouldn't expect to be coming to this place. But they're coming from that far because they have been prompted by God to do so. They are indeed, it says, the Lord and his instruments of indignation. And why are they coming? To destroy the whole land. So destruction is imminent. at the hands of these tools of God's wrath and indignation. In verse 2, it says, wave the hand, that they may enter the doors of the nobles. And I think what that communicates is, if they enter the doors of the nobles, this is a complete conquest. If they enter the doors of the commoners, that's not as big a deal. But if they enter the doors of the nobles, that is a complete conquest. And that's what's coming. Okay, where is this thing being raised? This standard. It doesn't tell us. All it tells us is that it's on this bare hill. Well, it does say that this prophecy is concerning Babylon. And there are other passages where Babylon is referred to as the mountain. And we'll look at another passage a little bit later in Jeremiah. We'll look at it because it has a lot of parallels to this passage. And it talks about Babylon referring to it as the mountain. So the best guess at this point is that the standard is being raised at Babylon. And that these armies are coming to Babylon to destroy Babylon. Verses 6 through 10. Wail, for the day of the Lord is near. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. Therefore all hands will fall limp, and every man's heart will melt, and they will be terrified. Pains and anguish will take hold of them. They will writhe like a woman in labor. They will look to one another in astonishment, their faces aflame. Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, cruel with fury and burning anger, to make the land a desolation, and he will exterminate its sinners from it. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not flash forth their light, and the sun will be dark when it rises, and the moon will not shed its light. So now it's describing the response of the people in this place when the destruction comes. The day of the Lord is a phrase that Isaiah uses a couple of times in Isaiah. In both instances, it's a day of punishment. It's a day of judgment that comes from God. And you get the sense that we know that God is a patient God. It is indeed amazing how long God allows people to manifest their wickedness before he steps in judgment. I think that is one of the difficulties that people all over the world face as they try to make sense of reality. And one of the problems is, why is there so much evil in the world? Why do we see people doing such horrible things and God allowing it to happen? But God is a patient God. He acts when he deems it appropriate. And it is amazing how much he allows to happen, how much human wickedness he allows to be manifest. And here in this place, apparently it is a place worthy of God's judgment. God has probably waited. And he has waited and allowed the people. What happens in God's patience is the wickedness of man sometimes interprets that as God either not being there or not caring. And in the absence of God's activity, man becomes arrogant and thinks that he is truly a significant creature who carries out marvelous things and is able to act with impunity. So when God shows up in judgment, the response is sheer terror. And it describes here, and you can almost, I can feel the feeling, you've probably felt the feeling. The hands go limp. The heart melts. There's sheer terror on their faces. And what do? They look to one another. as if there's help from our fellow man, as if our fellow man is going to be able to pull us out of this. But they're just as, their hands are just as limp and their heart just as melted as the other. And it describes the pain. Pains and anguish will take hold of them. They will writhe like a woman in labor. And largely, it's because of the judgment itself. It's because their wickedness, in a sense, is being exposed, and their helplessness, despite their arrogance. And it describes God's anger as a cruel anger. It says, cruel with fury and burning anger. And he is going to make the land a desolation and exterminate the sinners. So there's going to be a complete devastation of the place. Not only that, but there will be physical phenomena that will accompany this. No light from the stars, no light from the moon, and no light from the sun. So presumably there's going to be a cloud of some sort that's going to block out all of the light from the heavens, making it particularly ominous and, in a sense, indicating its divine nature. Verses 11 through 16. Thus I will punish the world for its evil, and the wicked for their iniquity. I will also put an end to the arrogance of the proud, and abase the haughtiness of the, and my translation says ruthless, but my margin says despots. And I suspect that that's a better translation. I will abase the haughtiness of the despots. I will make mortal man scarcer than pure gold, and mankind than the gold of Ophir. Therefore, I shall make the heavens tremble, and the earth will be shaken from its place at the fury of the Lord of hosts in the day of his burning anger. And it will be that like a hunted gazelle or a sheep with none to gather them, they will each turn to his own people and each one flee to his own land. Anyone who is found to be will be thrust through, and anyone who is captured will fall by the sword. Their little ones also will be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses will be plundered and their wives ravished. This is further description of this devastation that will come, and it is truly horrifying. He is going to punish the world for its evil, the wicked for their iniquity. And he will put an end to the arrogance of the proud and abase the haughtiness of the despots. Now, we're going to come back to this, why I think despots is a better term, in a little bit. But he is going to come punishing wickedness and arrogance of man, essentially. And this is going to be a devastating destruction in which very few will survive. Mortal man will be scarcer than pure gold, and mankind than the gold of Ophir. So this is going to be truly devastating. Very few people will survive. And then again, there will be accompanying physical phenomena. The heavens will tremble. The earth will be shaken from its place at the fury of the Lord of hosts. Okay. Now, in the response to this, the people are going to take off running, lost, leaderless, like a gazelle and a sheep. It says they will be like a hunted gazelle or a sheep with none to gather them. So it's like sheep without a shepherd, which is an interesting image. There's nothing worse than sheep without a shepherd. I mean, It is kind of interesting having sheep. You gather them together and gather them into a herd. And they are definitely herd animals. And when you're gathering them together, they're a little bit nervous. They don't know what's going to happen. And they seek comfort by banding together, which in some instances is wonderful because it makes it much easier to handle them because they're all together in one mob. But it's so stupid for them to think that they can really take on any significant challenge by gathering together. And without a leader. And I think that's hinting at part of the problem. In their arrogance, they don't recognize true leadership. That is, God-ordained authority. They do not recognize. And rather, they set up their own authorities, which are not truly leaders. They are, in fact, despots. So this image apparently is capturing a picture in which if this is Babylon, which was a multinational empire, in the course of the construction of this empire, these people have been mixed. But when trouble comes, they run to what seems to be safety. That is, they go home. So all these people are fleeing back to their homes, trying their own herds, in hope of escaping the wrath that's coming. Then it describes in the last verses horrible things. The stragglers will be thrust through. This is those who are found will be thrust through. Anyone who is captured will fall by the sword. And then the worst part of it, their little ones will be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses will be plundered and their wives will be ravished. I mean, this is war at its worst. This is uncivilized war, the kind of war that we're learning to become accustomed with. So that's the kind of destruction that is going to come upon this place when these armies gather. Now it talks about in this next section, it talks about the agents of this destruction, talking about the Medes, verses 17 through 22. Behold, I am going to stir up the Medes against them, who will not value silver or take pleasure in gold, and their bows will mow down the young men. They will not even have compassion on the fruit of the womb, nor will their eye pity children. And Babylon, the beauty of kingdoms, the glory of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It will never be inhabited or lived in from generation to generation, nor will the Arab pitch his tent there, nor will shepherds make their flocks lie down there. But desert creatures will lie down there, and their houses will be full of owls. Ostriches also will live there, and shaggy goats will frolic there, and hyenas will howl in their fortified towers, and jackals in their luxurious palaces. Her fateful time also will soon come, and her days will not be prolonged. So it describes then the Medes as carrying out this destruction, and the Medes come in and they are absolutely merciless. They will not value silver or take pleasure in gold. In other words, they can't be bought off. They are on a mission. They are determined. And they are going to mow down everyone with their bows, and they will not even have compassion on the fruit of the womb. So children will not be spared. So that's the fate that awaits this Babylon, which was, prior to this destruction, the beauty of kingdoms, the glory of the Chaldeans' pride. So it was a truly magnificent and awesome place. And yet it is going to be absolutely devastated, mercilessly destroyed. And it will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It's interesting, Isaiah has used this description before of the kind of destruction that will come. He used it before with reference to Israel, as I recall, either Israel or Judah. that they would be destroyed as Sodom and Gomorrah. But it's complete destruction. Sodom and Gomorrah had ceased to exist when God destroyed them. Babylon, similarly, for its wickedness, will cease to exist. And so it goes on to describe it will not be inhabited. The only inhabitants will be these wild animals that will come and live there. The Arab will not pitch its tent there. The shepherds will not leave their flocks there. There will just be there desert creatures such as owls and ostriches, shaggy goats, hyenas, jackals. That's all that will be there. A few years ago, we had a woman archaeologist that came here and showed us slides of Babylon. And it is indeed, to this day, out in the middle of nowhere. It is desolate. And they are doing some digging there, but apparently it's a difficult place to dig because the water table is so high, and as soon as you start digging, you get into water. But it is indeed desolate to this day. So the destruction that Isaiah is predicting here, it did come to pass. He said that Babylon's time was coming soon. Well, 200 years, that's soon. On God's time scale, that was soon. And it did indeed come. Okay. Now, as we look through this passage, it seems to make the most sense that what he is indeed talking about is Babylon. That this standard was raised on a hill that represents the empire of Babylon, and that it was destroyed by the Medes and the Persians. However, there is some language in this description that seems to go beyond anything that happened at Babylon. And we have to face into the same question that we have encountered elsewhere in Isaiah already. In particular, if you will recall, when we looked at, was it chapter 10? Yes. In chapter 10, the last half of chapter 10, when it was talking about the judgment that was to come upon Assyria, there was language there that seemed to go beyond anything that happened in Assyria. And so what I concluded is that it was talking about Assyria on the one hand, but only as a foreshadowing of a destruction that was going to come to a bigger entity than Assyria. That is, an entity with the spirit of Assyria, the same kind of pride and antagonism towards God. And we face that same problem here. And then the question is he describing these things using hyperbole, or is he talking about a different destruction? A more complete destruction, a more vast destruction, a more significant destruction of a bigger Babylon. Let me show you what I'm talking about. The first is the physical phenomena. I don't know, and I don't know if anyone knows, whether there were these physical phenomena that accompanied the destruction of Babylon. The Medes came in and they destroyed Babylon. That's known. But were there these accompanying physical phenomena? Did the stars go dark and the moon go dark and the sun go dark? Did the heavens tremble? Did the earth get shaken out of its place? Is that hyperbole, or are we talking about a more significant event? Or did these happen when Babylon fell? Another thing, look at verse 5 of 13. When it says, they are coming from a far country, from the farthest horizons. Literally, it means the ends of the heavens. An interesting turn of phrase. So again, is that hyperbole, or are we talking about an even greater event than happened when Babylon fell? And just one other thing that I'll point out, verse 11. It says, "Thus I will punish the world for its evil, and the wicked for their iniquity." Elsewhere it is talked about, it is used the Hebrew word eretz. And the Hebrew word eretz can just mean, it's like our word the land. It can just mean a geographical area on the earth, like the land of Israel. That is haaretz. I got my comments in there. So that's called haaretz. So sometimes eretz just means the land in the sense of a country. But other times it means the whole world, so it's ambiguous. And it earlier in the passage it talked about, verse 5, it said to destroy the whole land. But the word there is haaretz. So it's not clear whether it means the whole country or the whole world. But in verse 11, it's less ambiguous. The word is different there. It's tevel. And tevel does not mean a country. It's never used to refer to one country. It means the world. It means all the continents, most commonly. So there are just enough hints in here that we come up with the same dilemma. Do we see this as a hyperbolic and exaggerated description of the destruction that will come upon Babylon? Or are we talking about an even greater destruction to come? But if this greater destruction to come is going to be on Babylon, the question is, where is Babylon? Babylon has ceased to exist. How could there be a greater destruction on Babylon? Okay. I am convinced that Babylon is the end of sinful man. That all of the history of sinful man leads to Babylon. And let me describe what I mean. Babel is a city that is described in Genesis. It's a city in which the people cooperated. They got together and decided that they were going to make a great city. But in order to make a great city, they had to establish a community, a collective. They had to work together. And how do we bring about? How do we make it possible? Let me back up just a second. As human beings, we would all like to be gods. We all wish that we could order the whole universe to our liking. That's why Adam and Eve ate of the fruit in the garden. The only problem is, we are so small. When we look out at the forces of nature, we look out at the world around us, there is no question it's too big for us. We are overwhelmed by it. I mean, we're taken out. I mean, we were recently at the coast, and every time we go to the coast and I play in the water, I am amazed at the power of the surf. I mean, it's amazing. If you play in it hard, you quickly get tired out, and it keeps going. Well, if you think about that with respect to all of nature, we are really puny. There is no hope that we can control the forces that are out there that threaten us. Our only hope, as we're looking at it as sinful human beings, is the collective. If there are enough of us together working on it, then we can overcome the problems and challenges that are out there. And that was the spirit of Babel. We will build a city and a tower that will reach into heaven. We will aspire to divinity, essentially. We will make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered over the earth. So their only hope was the collective. And that's the spirit of Babel. I was talking to, a couple of years ago, I was talking to a friend of mine who is a doctor. And we were talking about, he was asking me questions about healthcare in the Soviet Union, which I didn't know a lot about, but I have spent some time there. And as I described healthcare in the Soviet Union, it's socialized medicine. In each area of town, there is a clinic. So everyone in the town then is assigned to a clinic. If you get sick, you go to your assigned clinic. And then one of the doctors there will treat you as you come in. You don't have to pay anything. Care is free. But you don't choose your doctor. The doctor is whoever is assigned to you. The doctors were not paid well because in the Soviet Union, everyone is equal, so everyone is paid the same amount. So taxi cab drivers get the same as doctors, more or less. The taxi cab drivers get a little more, is what I mean. There was a problem in the Soviet Union with healthcare because doctors weren't motivated to provide the services that were necessary. And there was rarely a personal relationship between the doctor and the people. And so the whole system was provided inadequate health care, really. Well, he was talking about what is happening in the United States. And he said that from his perspective, health care in the United States is moving in a similar direction. What's curious is we think in terms of communism and free enterprise as if they are polar opposites. Well, what's happening in the United States, at least at this point, is not government-imposed socialized health care, but it is insurance company-imposed socialized health care. That you almost have to have medical insurance in our day and age. And what you are doing is you are paying this organization to look out for your best interests. We should always be suspicious when that happens, because whose best interests is first and foremost in their minds as human beings? It's the insurance company. But we pay them to look out for our best interests, and we do it because we can't take the risk of a disastrous sickness and not having the health care coverage. So we are paying them for our security. So there's a sense in which the insurance company is the formation of the collective for our security. And what's interesting is we keep appealing to the collective, whether it's through the free enterprise system or whether it's directly to the government. We like to build up and make more powerful the collective in order to provide us with security. I'm convinced that's the end of sinful man, is the construction of the collective to provide the illusion of security for each of us. It's our fear and insecurity that drives us to the herd. If that's true, Babylon is inevitable. That there will be another Babylon. There will be the formation of the collective, the multinational collective, which will provide this promise of security for all. If that's true, then I suspect what it's talking about here is the destruction of that Babylon, ultimately. That the destruction of the Babylon that is in present-day Iraq is but a foreshadowing of the destruction of a greater Babylon, and it will be a greater destruction that is yet to come. But I hope that you understand how I got there. I mean, you all have to decide whether you think that I have understood this correctly. But there is this problem that we keep facing in Isaiah, and I suspect we'll face it again. And that is descriptions of things in the future, but they are described in such a way that it is either hyperbole, and we need to grant him that as because he's using poetry as the form of presentation of these prophecies. Is he presenting these prophecies in the form of hyperbole, and we just need to see it as that? Or are these instances of hyperbole hints that he's talking about something that is greater than what appears to be the case on the surface? And that's that decision that we're going to have to make a number of times in Isaiah, and it's a tough decision. Okay, questions, comments?
It kind of bothers me that this, the word of the prophet to these people wasn't to the people at that time in their own lives, to think about it that way. Is it possible that the writings have dual purpose? That is, that the destruction of the Babylon that they knew at that time is actually a living picture of the destruction of the Babylon that's going to happen when the hyperbole actually becomes realized?
Yeah. Well, first of all, there's a sense in which no matter how we interpret it, he can't be talking to the people of his time. Because Babylon is not even a power at the time that Isaiah is writing. It's 200 years later that the destruction of the literal Babylon takes place. So the people that are his immediate audience that he's writing to when he's living, they don't see the destruction of Babylon. They don't even see the rise of Babylon to become an empire. So in that sense, there's no way we can interpret it so that it's directed just to right to his audience. But there's another sense in which it's directed to any human being. And I think it is written to any human being in the sense that if we understand Babel as the end of sinful man, the inevitable culmination of the activity of people who are rebellious against God, then there is a relevance here, I think, to any generation. And that is, that rebelliousness is going to be judged, that God is going to absolutely wipe that out. And just one more thing. I have always been resistant to the concept of double fulfillment of prophecy. You've probably heard that term, where one prophecy has two fulfillments. But there is a sense in which I'm becoming more sympathetic with it. And that is, the way I'm conceiving it right now is that God seems to have this tendency of prophesying some event which is in the not terribly distant future, but that event is just a dress rehearsal for a more significant fulfillment of that same prophecy. And I'm beginning to suspect that we're seeing some of those kinds of things here. But we'll see. We'll see if that holds up, if that makes sense ultimately.
How many more years was it after this that Babylon came into power? Do you know that?
It would have been about between 80 and 100 years.
And do you know if the events like the moon being covered and things like that, did that happen, or is that just part of the hyperbole as well?
I don't know for sure. I cannot say for sure. My suspicion is that it's part of the hyperbole, but I cannot say for sure. That could have literally happened at the time of the fall of Babylon.
I'm sorry, I think maybe I missed. I thought you were going one way, and then in what you just said, it sounded like you're going the other, so I'm going to ask you to clarify which way you're going. See, okay, you're kind of modeling for us the sort of double meaning kind of, okay, that's good. Well, my question has multiple meanings
good.
As well, so.
I'll answer all of them.
Right. You pointed us in the text to certain things that you said we had to face the question as to whether they were hyperbole or that whether they were kind of indicators that this, that there was this bigger thing included in the destruction that you were talking about. I thought I heard you kind of leaning in the direction that this was not hyperbole, that that those indicators, you know, the whole world and the sun being darkened and all of that, is you were kind of painting the picture, I thought, of, yes, we'll get specific and say the Medes are going to come along and overthrow the nation of Babylon, but the kind of judgment I'm talking about ultimately, it just starts there, but ultimately it is this cataclysmic, earth-shaking thing. That's what I thought I heard you saying. But then you just said that sun and moon stuff you thought was hyperbole. So did I... I'm not... Which are you saying?
Let me see. Well, I'm still playing. It's still in process. But the way that I'm seeing it is that something similar to what is being described here happens to the literal Babylon. But that is not ultimately what is being prophesied. It is not the ultimate fulfillment of that prophecy, that is yet to come. And that will happen to another Babylon and by other Medes.
And will the sun be dark and that earth shake and that kind of stuff when that happens?
That's my premise.
Okay. Since I've got the mic, can I just ask you one more question? Have you given any thought at all to, I hear you describing what sounds like you're sort of developing a prophetic vocabulary and saying that Babylon has a certain, is used in this way because of its associations with Babel and with the idea of, you know, the mankind joining together in its sort of hubris and that sort of thing. Have you given any, is that what you're saying? And have you given any thought to, you know, like the book of Revelation with Babylon, the harlot, and all that kind of stuff? Are you seeing that sort of carrying through?
Have I looked at Revelation in this light? The answer is no. Has it occurred to me that there is that kind of association? The answer is yes. And I'm beginning to become suspicious that Isaiah is doing this not just with Babylon, but also with Assyria. This Assyria takes on kind of a symbolic significance here, as I think here Babylon does, that it Assyria represents a kind of spirit within mankind that ultimately will be judged by God, just as here Babylon comes to be symbolic of this particular aspect of human nature that will be manifest in a larger entity that will be destroyed by God. But I'm in process. Well, you can just stay tuned, and you guys can think along with me and see how we modify the theory as time goes on.
Well, that's good. I mean, I'm in that same process and would say with you that it is possible that it's just hyperbole.
Right.
It all has been fulfilled already, but that pattern seems to be showing up again and again. And
that's part of my... that's part of what has piqued my interest, is that it seems to happen in every one of these prophetic passages, and in such a way that it's just a little hard to see it as only hyperbole.
Hi.
Hi.
Closer. Okay. As far as the context of the spirit of Babylon that you've referred to, as far as that spirit is concerned, yes, there have been empires throughout history that have risen and attained pride, material wealth, arrogance, and then completely collapsed, and so forth, until the final big thing happens. In my own view, as far as our day and age is concerned, and I see kind of our country as a type of Babylon, as it were, the same spirit of material wealth, arrogance, economic power, unsurpassed by any other nation, at least in this century, and that we are a nation gathered from multiple nationalities around the world, for the most part, and as far as just looking at our own country and how quickly, as with other nations before us, how quickly that can be gone in an hour, in a day, as the book of Revelation describes, and all the people, all the merchants of the world having invested their wealth in this quote-unquote Babylon, and all of that gone, you know, for whatever reason, and so forth and so on. I don't know if you're thinking of an ultimate Babylon as far as relating to the beast and the system and all that. I don't know what you're referring to there, but it's good for us to kind of look at events today and just see, where is our country at spiritually, economically? Do we resemble any kind of any spirit of Babylon as has happened in the past? Because they all met the same fate, you know, and I guess my point is, we keep our eye on the Lord and the real kingdom that matters, and it doesn't matter what earthly kingdom we live in, just so long as we're aware. I see what you're saying. I mean, I think it's very vital and essential to where we're at.
I think the key question is, who is our God? In Babel, the God became the unity, the collective. That when it came right down to it, when they were, to whom did they look for their salvation? It was to the collective. And it's important for us to keep that question in mind. That is, to whom do I look for salvation? Who ultimately is my Savior? And that's a critical question. And the spirit of Babel says it is the collective.
I've actually thought about this quite a bit for over the last year and a half, and I would just like to have everybody, encourage everybody here, if they might consider when they go home, reading through Revelation chapter 18, because it describes in shocking detail specifics that this future Babylon, which you speak of, would be in the future engaging in, as far as types of worldwide activities. And last but not least, to hitchhike on what you said, how absolutely sudden all that would be brought to an end, and the shock of the surrounding nations that did commerce. Would say, they'd said four times in response to this massive event, she fell in literally 1 hour. In 1 hour. And, so, and it states that four times. There's a big emphasis on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are lots of details that we could get into with respect to why I think that Babel is the end of sinful man, the inevitable end of sinful man. But one of the things that I would encourage people to read about and think about is the evolution of economic systems within the world over time. And we have created an economy that is absolutely phenomenal. I think of it in terms of a huge glass sculpture. Absolutely gorgeous, but nothing could be more fragile. Because if you look at how things work, the whole thing depends on trust, ultimately. And all you need is a seed of doubt, and the whole thing comes down like a house of cards. Yep. It's really amazing.
Actually, this question has sort of been answered by the last few questions and comments, but when you compared government-regulated healthcare and corporate-regulated healthcare, mm-hmm. basically, to that spirit of Babel. So, would you say that people who are whose motivation is to serve God in their formation of in their sort of herding together communities, like I'm thinking particularly of people who make intentional communities, the Amish, the Friends, and so forth, in which to they herd together through with a different motivation. I mean, is mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. sort of a good differentiation to make? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we are herd animals.
Yeah,
we can't change that, and we shouldn't change that. I mean, there's something good about community. But what I'm talking, the spirit of Babel is different. The spirit of Babel says, community is my salvation. And that is not true. So there's nothing wrong with community, but there is something wrong with what I'm calling the collective, and that is community for the purpose of the salvation of our souls, because it cannot do that.
Spirit of the collective be defined as self-reliance? I mean, the arrogance and the material stuff, what's really underneath that is self-reliance as opposed to trusting God.
It is, but it's, but self, if we can make self plural, because the self is the collective, that is, reliance on a human,
right.
on a human institution.
Right.
That is, we create this state and count on it.
It's like we all agree
to be our Savior.
We all agree together.
Right, right, right. And when the day comes, everybody's going to be looking at each other for what are you going to do to help me out of this? And yet there will be no salvation.
Dave, do you see Isaiah here reporting what he saw? And if we would walk up to him and say, well, are you talking about a short-term prophecy and a long-term prophecy? He would say, I don't know. I'm just telling you what I saw. I don't know what it means. Do you think he knew whether he was writing about both a short-term and a long-term prophecy, or was he just reporting what he saw?
I don't know. In this particular instance, there are some instances where he will report a vision and then he goes on with what seems to be his own comments, continuing comments on that vision. In this case, he doesn't do that. So I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know whether he understood what he was seeing or whether he is just reporting what he saw.
Well, so that makes interpreting what he's saying here pretty difficult mm-hmm. if we don't know whether he's reporting just what he saw.
Because, yes, it's difficult.
Because he's not expressing any specific
right.
intent.
We've got the vision from God is essentially what we're interpreting, and that is as relayed to us through the words of Isaiah. I'm assuming that those words are inspired, so the words are adequate to communicate what God wanted to communicate from that vision, at least adequate from his perspective, maybe not from ours. But yes, it's difficult.
I'm not expecting that I'll be able to become unconfused today about this. But if, as you're in Isaiah, if you can keep coming back to it, I'm really confused about the difference between the double fulfillment of prophecy that you would see as a real disabling of language and, you know, not being logical and not, and really kind of a defeating and not helpful way of looking at prophecy, and the possibility of a prophecy addressing something, you know, within a couple hundred years and something at the end times. And so if during the course of looking at this you can keep defining both of them, and mm-hmm. I know you're in process mm-hmm. of the second one, but it would, maybe I could even catch up to where that process okay. is at.
Could you, would you describe again the first option?
Okay. what I have heard, Ron and I guess I've mainly heard Ron define it, and he can maybe help if I'm getting this anywhere close to right, that the objection to double fulfillment of prophecy is that the Bible is communicating to us in a language that intends to say one thing, and to start trying to have it saying, you know, this and that and this and that really is saying that the Bible is not using language in that common sense
right,
way.
Right.
That's what I meant.
Right. I agree with that principle. I am trying not to violate that principle. So, and that's where it comes back to Ron's question. That was Ron's confusion in what I was saying. And is this prophecy ultimately about Babylon, or is this prophecy ultimately about some other destruction that is coming? And forced to choose between those two, my response would be, it's the latter. It's a destruction yet to come. However, God worded it in such a way that there is this kind of dress rehearsal that approximates a fulfillment of this prophecy. It's like a down payment. It's like saying, the real thing is coming.
But when the people who were aware of the prophecy, were the people who heard the prophecy living at the time of the destruction of Babylon? Oh. I missed that part. But they were aware of the prophecy, probably, if they were,
through
if
Isaiah.
They cared about
yes.
it. Yeah.
Through Isaiah.
Mm-hmm. So they were aware of it. And then when the destruction of Babylon happened, wouldn't they have considered that a fulfillment?
They may very well have, yes.
And would they have been wrong that it was only a partial fulfillment? Or
they would have been, if I am correct, they would have been wrong to see it as the full fulfillment, as the fulfillment, the ultimate fulfillment of that prophecy. All it is a foreshadowing. It's a that the defeat of Babylon was but a dress rehearsal rather than the real thing. The real thing is yet to come. And what's being described here really is the real thing.
Is it a prophecy of a pattern of God's relationship towards Babylon?
In a sense, it is God's, it is demonstrating how God responds to the spirit of Babylon, yes. And that is a pattern that we see not only in the destruction of Babylon, but we see that elsewhere.
It's helpful. I'm still.
Yep. But that's good, though. Those are good questions. That helps. One last question.
Okay, to get the historical chronology set, this all happened obviously before the time of Christ, both this prophecy in Isaiah. And the destruction of then the kingdom Babylon.
The literal Babylon.
Right. Jesus came, was resurrected. We're now in the church age. After all that came, or right at the close of the first century, there's another prophecy in Revelation which really validates your point. Namely, gee, this could have been a foreshadowing because there came a second prophecy in Revelation, which went into much more detail about another Babylon, which was yet to come.
Okay, thank you.